From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the afterlife. But here's what's happening. Well, the primaries are getting more and more confusing. Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Bernie Sanders won Wisconsin's presidential nominating contest Tuesday night, dampening Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's hopes of wrapping up the race anytime soon and putting heavy pressure on the front runners to recapture the momentum in contests later this month. Sanders, in particular, has been on a winning streak of late, vowing to take his insurgent campaign next to Clinton's adopted home state of New York, which votes in 2 weeks. His win in Wisconsin is his sixth of the last seven primaries and caucuses. And Texas Senator Ted Cruz also pointed to his win Tuesday night as a sign that the tides are turning against Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. First, let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, for his reaction to tonight's victories by Sanders and Cruz. John?
Oh, hey, George. Well, I think here, let's get the big picture here, okay? Sanders is a real long shot to win New York, and it's great that he won Wisconsin, and I think that the big picture and message for the Hillary campaign is that there's weakness in the party and division, which means that if you look at the Republican, whoever the nominee is going to be, it's either really going to only be Cruz or Trump. It's not going to be Kasich. There's a rule that prohibits him from receiving the nomination. It's not going to change. So it means that there's only two people left in this race. There's not going to be any, you know, backroom smoke-filled deal where somebody like Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan comes out of the woodwork. That is just utter nonsense. It's not going to happen. So what you're looking at right now is great victory for Bernie. He goes into New York, highly likely to lose New York, and then the balloon of the Sanders campaign is virtually going to, the air is going to be let out of the balloon, as it were. Trump now heads, you know, well, Cruz is pounding his chest.
Brokered convention, John.
Well, I'm telling you, the brokered convention that is going to exist is not going to be what you think it's going to be. It's going to be the Cruz campaign and the Trump campaign, you know, working some kind of a deal out with delegates, and it's going to be resolved between those two individuals. So I think as you look forward now to the the elections and Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, it means Trump is going to rack up a lot more delegates right now, which is going to make it mathematically impossible for Cruz not to just get to the magic number, but really to have a lion's share of delegates. And the West Coast is not really going to be all that much favorable to Cruz either. So my I've really done, had some talks with some DNC and RNC insiders on this. And they're telling me now, George, from the RNC, that only two candidates will emerge. It will either be Trump or Cruz with the nomination in a contested convention. And I think that's beginning to be the consensus. And I think what happens before the convention is the horse trading will go on. And I do think that there'll be some kind of a deal between Cruz and Trump prior to the convention.
Okay, we shall see. Thank you, John. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Now let's check in, of course, with Howard Bloom, author of The Genius of the Beast. Howard, your take on tonight?
Well, basically, the psychology goes like this. We're fed up, but we are having a very hard time articulating why. And Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who lost tonight, have come closer to articulating our feelings than anybody else out there. We seem to feel that insiders are pigging out at the trough, and the rest of us are locked out on the outside. Now, whether those outsiders are Washingtonians, billionaires, or minorities, on the right, there's a rebellion of the white, undereducated males who feel that blacks are getting special privileges. On the left, there's a rebellion of the young. In Wisconsin, Republican, now get this, this is in the last 12 hours, 14 hours, in Wisconsin, Republicans under 30 are not voting. But Bernie Sanders is winning 60% of the Democratic youth vote, Why? There's a basic fact that we're not facing. Student debt is turning college kids, no matter what their party, into indentured servants, into almost slaves. And Bernie says that college should be free. Meanwhile, Trump was winning white undereducated males up until now everywhere. But in Wisconsin, they went for Cruz by a very slight, very tiny margin. Why? It might be that six talk radio show hosts in Wisconsin turned on Trump, and they roasted him. They blasted him every day for weeks. And those six talk radio show hosts seem to favor the policies of the billionaire donors. But more than that is bothering us, and we don't know what it is. What we feel we need is truth. And up until now, and we said this last night, Trump and Sanders have been hitting the truth the most. Trump blasts politicians who are paid off by the powerful and trade deals that hate workers. Well, guess what? So does Bernie Sanders. He hits those same two things. And what truth, if any, does Cruz tap? That we don't want Donald Trump. And there's one more emotional factor. It's that strange feeling that we call a sense of momentum. Social psychology studies show that when somebody is winning, like your sports team, we say, we won. But when somebody is losing, like your sports team, we say, they lost. Not we, they. And Bernie has won, by my math, seven out of his latest eight contests. So he is doing a good job of projecting momentum. So was Donald Trump. But Trump, here's the deal. Trump may have lost it in a moment that went by so fast, most people don't think they noticed it. When he said in the last week, we should let Japan and South Korea have nukes, Donald Trump no longer sounded strong, and he no longer sounded like he was the man who could restore American greatness. So if we are lucky, this campaign will help us get whatever is bothering us out in the open where we can talk about it and where we can do something about it, because that's the power of truth.
This is still one of those upside-down elections. Thanks, Howard. Satellite images have reported and recorded suspicious activity at North Korea's main nuclear complex, according to a report by a U.S.-based think tank. The report by the website 38 North, that's what it's called, which is run by the John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, claims that exhaust plumes had been spotted at least twice in the past 5 weeks at the complex. The plumes suggest the buildings at the complex are being heated, though it's not clear why. Authorities say a young man has died and another was injured after a model rocket exploded at a Southern California school. Ventura County Sheriff's authorities say the 18-year-old man suffered critical injuries, died at a hospital. Another juvenile was taken to the hospital with minor injuries. The two apparently were using a small propane cylinder to make a model rocket, and the cylinder exploded in someone's hands. Folks, I used to launch model rockets as a kid. There's a company in Colorado. It's called Estes. They have safe rocket engines there. Don't play around with propane cylinders. You'll see what happens just to this poor young 18-year-old. The normal decline in memory and intellect that comes with aging may occur earlier and faster in men than women, says a study in psychology and aging. Older women outscored older men on tests of cognitive function administered over nearly a decade, according to the study. Men also showed a faster decline in specific cognitive abilities, such as mental agility, whereas there was no measurement in which women had a steeper decline compared with men. Let's check in with the author of Tickle Your Amygdala, Neil Slade, on this one. So it looks like the male intellect, the memory may deteriorate faster than women, Neil.
Yes. Well, my wife has said she believes it begins at around age 7 in men. I think, you know, I really had to think about what may be the cause of that. And one of the things that I came upon was that one of the causes of cognitive dysfunction as you get older comes from loneliness, a lack of a social network, and high stress. And as men reach retirement age and older, their life changes in a more dramatic fashion, perhaps, than it does for women. And whereas men may get a lot of their cognitive stimulation from their employment situation as they retire and get away from work. They lose that kind of stimulation. And I think that might be part of the reason why there is a difference in the rate of brain decline. Now, the study that you're talking about was averaged the results from about 2,000 older people ages 50 to 96. So it's not, it doesn't mean that everyone, every male will lose that ability faster, but on the average. So I think we have to look at the cultural differences in men and women and some other factors that may play an important part in that difference in cognition decline.
What a great story. Neil, thank you so much. In Minnesota, a Wisconsin woman is suing a Rochester, Minnesota funeral home in the Mayo Clinic after her husband's body was accidentally cremated. Jennifer Huber's husband, Tony, died last May after he hit his head during a fall at their home. His body was taken to a morgue at Mayo and moved from one spot to another without being documented. When the funeral home arrived to pick up another body, they took Tony's body instead, and he was cremated. Up next, it's called The New Case for Gold, The Death of Money as well. Jim Rickard's back with us on Coast to Coast. We're going to talk about your money on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Next couple hours, we're really going to learn something. Jim Rickard's back with us, Chief Global Strategist at the West Shore Funds and Director of the James Rickards Project. Now, that's an inquiry into the complex dynamics of geopolitics and global capital. He's been a portfolio manager, lawyer, economist. In 1998, he was the principal negotiator of the Rescue LTCM sponsored by the Federal Reserve. He is an advisor on capital markets to the U.S. intelligence community and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. His latest work, The New Case for Gold, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jim, good to have you back.
Thank you, George. Great to be with you.
Well, the economy seems to be holding on, but is it by a thread or is there some base underneath it to keep it propped up?
You know, it's somewhere in between, to be honest. We have been growing for 8 years, but we have been growing at the slowest pace of any recovery in U.S. history. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's not a recession. You know what this is? Technically, we're in a depression, and everyone thinks of the Great Depression. But, you know, the definition of a depression is when you can have some growth, but it's below potential. So the U.S. economy has the potential to grow 3 or 4%. We're actually growing about 2%. So 2% is growth, but it's way below 3% or 4%. So that gap between the 3 or 4% that we could do and the 2% that we are doing, that's an output gap. That's lost wealth, and you never get it back. So we've lost trillions of dollars of output relative to our potential. So we're kind of muddling through okay, but not better than that, certainly not what America is capable of.
Jim, the Federal Reserve has kind of held the line on interest rates. It's only bumped it once in all these years, a quarter of a percent. Now there's talk of negative interest rates. Does that mean if you have $100 in the bank and you go to get it, you might only get $98 back?
It's exactly what that means. Negative interest rate is when they take money out of your account. You know, you put $100 in the bank, even at 1%, you come back a year later, you got 101. Now you put $100 in the bank, you come back a year later, and you got 98 or 99, as the case may be. But there's an interesting aspect of this, George, which is, well, people say, well, okay, that's an easy thing to fix. I'll just go down to the bank, get my cash, put it in a coffee can or something, bury it in the backyard, find a safe place for it. A year later, I still have my $100, but, you know, the guy next door, he's only got 99 because of the negative rates. So this is where the war on cash comes in. The banks and the fiscal authorities, the tax authorities, are actually making it impossible to get cash, because as long as people can get cash, they have an alternative to negative interest rates. They just take it out of the bank. But if everything is digitized, if they force you to have digital wealth, meaning it's an electronic form of wealth in the bank or on a brokerage account or whatever, then there's no escape. That's where gold comes in. That's part of what I talk about in my book, The New Case for Gold, because you can have physical gold. It's legal, believe it or not, and it's one way to protect yourself against negative rates.
Well, we've been bullish on gold and silver for years here, Jim, and I still think both of them are poised for some pretty good returns.
Well, gold is the best performing asset class of 2016. I think the listeners know it's up almost 20%, not quite, but close to 20% this year. It's also the best performing asset class of the 21st century. If you go back to 2000, so the last 16 years, gold has easily outperformed stocks. So short-term, gold's doing better. Long-term, gold's doing better. It is true that from August 2011 to November 2015, so a little over four-year patch there, gold was down about 45%. But that's not unusual in commodities. When something's going to the moon, there's usually what's called a 50% retracement. It doesn't go up in a straight line. It goes up and down, up and down. I mean, it's volatile. Listeners know that. But a large drawdown is normal. That does happen quite a bit. But it seems that we're past that. Now we're kind of poised for much higher gold prices.
Should people panic when their holdings like that go down? Even stocks, Jim, because, you know, you really don't lose the money until you sell. Why don't people just hold on because everything seems to be cyclical?
Well, I think they should. I think that's good advice, with one exception, which is we seem to have these major financial panics every 7 or 8 years like clockwork. I mean, go back to October 1987. The stock market fell 22% in one day, not a week or a month, but one day. So in today's terms, that would be the equivalent. 22% drop today would be 4,000 points.
Oh, my God. People would be jumping out of windows.
Well, that's right. You know, if it went down 400 points, that's all anybody would be talking about. This would be 4,000 down points. That's the equivalent of 22%.
Would those safety mechanisms kick in if it dropped that much in one day?
Well, they do. They made some changes. They've got circuit breakers. But then you just close the market, open it the next day, and the plunge could continue. But even, you know, beyond that, there was 1998. Every market in the world was hours away from closing. Now, it didn't happen because we bailed out long-term capital management. That was the hedge fund in 1998 that was failing side by side with Russia. I did that bailout. I negotiated that bailout. I was the chief lawyer for LTCM, so I had a front row seat on that one. But no one slept for 5 days. We worked around the clock. We did get it done, kind of like foaming the runways when the plane's coming in with the engines on fire. But the fact is we were hours away from shutting every market in the world. 2000, the dot-com crash. 2007, the mortgage crash. 2008, Lehman Brothers and AIG. So these things happen with some regularity. And I think that the answer, George, is, and this is obvious, but diversification. So what I recommend, have some gold, have some cash, have some money in the stock market, if you like. And that way, you know, if one thing plunges, the other things will hopefully hold up okay.
I was watching a new release movie at home a couple weeks ago called Short Sell, and it was about these guys. It was a movie about how they were able to foretell the bubble in the housing market. Then they knew the derivatives were going to blow up, so they sold everything short, and they made a lot of money doing that. Are these predictors? I mean, are there people out there that actually know what's going to happen in the next 6 months to a year?
You can have a pretty good idea if you have the right models. Now, that's the key thing, because a lot of the models that the Federal Reserve uses and the IMF, a lot of academics, are highly flawed. I mean, I don't want to, you know, turn this into a technical science class, but they use what they call equilibrium models. It's kind of like, you know, the economy is a clock. It winds down, you wind it up again. It slows down, you wind it up again. Almost like the thermostat in your house. You know, it's too cold, you dial it up. It's too warm, you dial it down. These are what they call linear models, you know, up and down, forward, back. That is not a good representation of how the economy works. The economy works much more like a nuclear power plant. So you can dial a nuclear power plant up, but you better get it right, because if you don't, you're going to have a catastrophic meltdown, and that's what these market crashes are. Short answer to the question is you can predict markets, but you need the right models, the right complexity models. This is a lot of the work I did for the intelligence community after 9/11, because, you know, there was insider trading. This is demonstrated. This isn't really subject to doubt. I talk about this in my second book, The Death of Money. There was insider trading.
Huge, too, wasn't it?
Huge, yeah, in American Airlines and United Airlines, in those airline stocks on the last two trading days before the attack. So I was actually invited in by the CIA. We weren't investigating that. We looked at it a little bit, but that was really the job of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security and the SEC and others. What we wanted to do was say, okay, if there's going to be another terrorist attack, will there be insider trading? Can you spot it? Can you trace it to a source, get a warrant, break down the door, and stop the attack? That was our mission. We worked on it for 7 years.
Great idea.
at the CIA, and we basically answered all those questions in the affirmative. You could spot it, you could trace it to the source, and you could get a warrant, you could stop the attack. We actually built a system.
Hold on for a second, Jim. I want to talk about that. That's an important facet. Jim Rickard's with us, his latest book, The New Case for Gold. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Going to open up our phones next hour with Jim Rickards as we talk about the new case for gold. I can't wait to get into this aspect of short sellers during terrorist attacks. That's an amazing, amazing research if you could see that coming before the event occurs. That's something else. Okay, welcome back to Coast. James Rickards with us, his book, The New Case for Gold. Let's get into the short sellers, Jim. If we're able to find that out, what an incredible story that would be. Now, did they ever publicize who sold those stocks short for during 9/11?
The actual identity of the sellers has not been publicized. I talk about this in my second book, The Death of Money. This is in Chapter 1. There's some indication that it started in Europe, and that would make sense, particularly in Spain. But that was a criminal act that we looked at after the fact. What we were trying to do at the CIA was to say, okay, could we catch it the next time? You know, the CIA is an intelligence agency. It's not a law enforcement agency. So it was the job of the FBI to go catch the bad guys. But what we did, George, we built a system. Well, I mean, just to give you an example on 9/11, this last two trading days, the average daily volume in puts, when you buy a put option, that's a bet that the stock is going to go down. We don't have to get too technical on stock trading. But buying a put option is a bet that the stock is going to go down. The average daily, the trading in United Airlines and American Airlines was 286 times the average daily volume. So imagine on an average day there's 1,000 shares short, and now the day before the attack there's 286,000 shares.
Jeez.
When you see that, you can see, because that information is available on a ticker. You can buy information feeds from the exchange. When you see that, you know something's up. You don't automatically know it's a terrorist attack. It could be.
Right.
It could be something else.
It could be the plane fuel is going to skyrocket or something
that. That's exactly right. The second thing you do, the first thing you do is you look for what's called the anomaly. You look for the odd trading, the thing that's unusual. And then you ask yourself a question. You look at the news. Did the CEO just jump off the roof? Did a competitor come up with a new product? Well, now you have an explanation. You say, okay, it's going down, but I understand why it's going down. But the trick is, when you see the anomaly, when you see the pricing information, and there's no news, there's no explanation for it, you know that somebody knows something you don't.
That's right.
Because people aren't crazy, right? They're doing it for a reason. So now you can start the intelligence process with the inferential technique and say, okay, who could it be? What's the motivation? It's just like solving a crime, but you're solving the crime in advance, or you're solving it in real time. We actually call this the invisible fish. So imagine the bad guy is a fish swimming in the water, and the fish is invisible, but you can't see it. But you've got perfect information about the water. You can tell from the ripples and where's the fish, what's the direction, how fast is it going. You can tell all that from the ripples in the water, even if you can't see the fish. So market information are like the ripples. That you can do with the right technique. So we're talking about spotting terrorism in advance, but you could spot market meltdowns. You could spot insider trading. And the folks you talked about in the movie The Big Short, they were spotting a mortgage meltdown that was coming. And nobody was talking about it. Wall Street never tells you these things. They either don't see it because they've got the wrong models, or they're motivated to keep their mouth shut because they're trying to take your money. But for independent analysts, intelligence community, hedge funds, or others who are looking at this independently, yes, you can see this stuff coming.
Now, were there any quiet arrests with short sellers during 9/11?
It was really, the answer is no. I don't want to say it was covered up, but there didn't seem to be a big interest in pursuing it. And again, I was brought in as a capital markets expert, and my job was to build a system that could spot it the next time, and we did. I'll give you a very concrete example.
Let me ask you this, though, really quickly, Jim. Wouldn't that pinpoint people who either knew in advance of 9/11 or they were the ones involved with it?
Well, there's no question people knew in advance. There was no question it was insider trading. As far as I'm concerned, again, I talk about this in my book. I don't want to...
Could have been people in government who knew.
Well, now there's another phenomenon we should explain. We call it signal amplification. Let me explain what that is. So let's say the bad guy comes in and trades 5,000 shares, okay, because he's trying to make, you know, $50,000. And if you're a safe house operator in the terrorist social network, you're somebody's mother, father, brother, sister, you're a cook, you know, think of like the Godfather, they have all these little minions running around cooking the meatballs or whatever. You're one of those guys, you know about it, you trade 5,000 shares. Now, that order goes to a specialist on the Chicago Board Options Exchange. So he sees it and says, huh, there's no news, somebody's shorting the stock, maybe I'll buy 10,000 shares, you know, I'll short 10,000 shares in my own account. Well, that crosses the tape, and then some hedge fund sees 15,000 shares short, and they say, you know what, I'll short 50,000 shares. Somebody, in other words, everybody says, somebody knows something I don't, and they piggyback on the trade. Well, you get to the end of the day, maybe there's a million shares short, but 995,000 of the shares could be innocent piggybacking by people who are just doing what I described. They're watching the tape, seeing somebody, they say somebody's got inside information. I don't know what it is. Maybe, I don't even know if it's a terrorist, but I'm going to piggyback on that trade. So the hard part is, you got a million shares short, only 5,000 are the terrorists. And this is where I think the SEC did mess up the investigation, because they went after the big guys. Well, you go after the big guys, they always have an excuse. Like, some of these guys actually pay for research on both sides of the trade, so if the SEC investigates them, they can always pick up a research report. No, no, I'm not an insider trader. I read it right here in this research report, and the SEC goes away. So a lot of the trading could actually have been innocent piggybacking. There is a bad guy in there somewhere, but it could be relatively small. And that's one of the difficulties of tracing this back to the source. I mean, this is hard work. But in 2006, I was sitting, you know, I'm a little bit of a night owl. I was working at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I got an email from my partner, because we were monitoring the markets for exactly this kind of thing. And we saw, we got a red light. We built a system with like red, yellow, green. It has a lot of computer algorithms behind it, but the interface was red, yellow, green. It was flashing red in American Airlines. This was around August 7th, 2006. So my partner sent me an email and said, looks like something's up. Well, we alerted the authorities. We waited a day. We waited another day. Monday, nothing happened. Tuesday, nothing happened. So Wednesday, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm working late. I got the TV on CNN with the sound turned down. And it's London, and it's about 7 o'clock in the morning in London. And I see all these police going in, raiding apartments, arresting people, walking out with computers. Well, this was the August 2006 airline plot when Al-Qaeda tried to blow up 10 airlines in midair, mostly with Americans, and killed 3,000 Americans in midair. And they were targeting American Airlines and United Airlines because, of course, they had the most Americans on board. So MI5 and MI6, Pakistani intelligence and CIA, actually broke up this plot. But my point is, 2 days before, using our system, we got a bright red light on American Airlines. So we saw that coming 2 days in advance, using these predictive analytics. So as it applies to today, yes, those systems are possible. Certain people have them. I built one with my partner for the CIA. It was a prototype, but it worked fine. And you can see market meltdowns coming. This is actually why I wrote my book, The New Case for Gold, because I'm trying to warn people that this is happening again. I was, you know, I lived through 98. That was enough for me to, candidly, I lost a lot of money. I was a big investor in the fund, and, you know, that's too bad for me. That was my decision. But I made a kind of vow to myself never to let it happen again. I was the lawyer, so I did my job in terms of negotiating the bailout, but I looked at all the Nobel Prize winners and the 170 IQs and the quants, and I said, you guys obviously don't understand, you know, capital markets, because this wouldn't have happened. And so I set out to figure out how things actually work.
Well, and you've done a great job doing that. I'm baffled that they didn't go after anybody legally and criminally during 9/11. When they know who bought, who shorted all those stocks, don't they?
Well, they know a lot of them, but you know, as I said, a lot of the people who shorted them were actually innocent. They were piggybacking on the original signal. You got to get all the way down to that little guy who started it. You know, it's like a snowflake and an avalanche.
Sure.
We can all see the avalanche, but can you find the snowflake?
But I guess I'm convinced Osama bin Laden had somebody do that for him.
Well, that's entirely likely. I mean, we, as I say, with the best information we saw was that the trading started in Spain, came out of Europe. Spain, of course, is right across the Straits of Gibraltar from Morocco. That's you know, permeated with Al-Qaeda terrorists, and that makes sense. By the way, after the 9/11 attack, the first kind of videotape of bin Laden that surfaced around November 2001, so just a couple months after the attack, was him sitting around with a bunch of sheikhs, and all he talked about was finance. He had calculated in his head the exact losses on the New York Stock Exchange, how much it had cost the U.S. economy, what the after effect was in hotels, travel, airlines. I mean, he had these numbers, and that's publicly available. The transcript of that meeting is publicly available. But bin Laden always said, he said, no, we're not going to kill all the Americans. He would like to, right? But he said, we're not going to kill them all. We're going to bankrupt them. We're going to make it so
that's what he wanted to do.
And so costly. And you know what? They're doing a good job of that.
What if, and this would be small potatoes, but let's say the guy who owned the flight training center where these terrorists were training, and, you know, he knew something was wrong because I think he tried to report it to people. You know, this is weird. These people don't want to learn how to land. They just want to learn how to fly. And what if he went out and sold short all these airline stocks because he figured there's something strange going on here?
Well, that's certainly possible. But it's a good example, George. Without, that could be the person. Like I said, it could be someone in the social network. But that's exactly how things work. The idea that this was only known to 20 hijackers and Bin Laden is complete nonsense. It was definitely known by a much wider network, whether that's a social network, even the 9/11 Commission report. And I don't think they did a very good job on what we're talking about right now. And I explain that in my book, The Death of Money. I explain how the 9/11 Commission missed what we're talking about. But there was one of the hijackers. He was coming from the Middle East to Miami and stopped in Mecca to visit his cousin and told her something's coming. So, yeah, and then you talk to people about this, and I encounter a lot of skepticism at CIA. People said, oh, you know, they would never compromise operational security by revealing the details of the attack. That's nonsense. I had a two-word answer for them, which is Martha Stewart. Yes. Martha Stewart was a legitimate billionaire. She made $1 billion legitimately, but she ended
sure
up behind bars over $100,000
something
trade.
Stupid, yeah.
Stupid, yeah, but it's that also an aspect of human nature. We can't resist betting on a sure thing. So between greed and the desire to bet on a sure thing, here's a billionaire who ends up in jail over $100,000. $100,000 is nothing to her, but she couldn't resist the trading. So the short answer is yes, people will engage in insider trading on this. Small trades can lead to piggyback trades. The people who are piggybacking, they don't necessarily know there's an attack, but they do know that something's up. They know that somebody knows something they don't, and then it gets amplified. A lot of this is a little technical, but going back to your original question, you can see these things coming.
I was, this is an interesting story, much down the lines of these discussions, that several years ago, hired to do a series, and we're still doing them, of TV shows by a publicly held company. And at that time, its stock was selling at $2.25 a share. And I knew that the minute we went in and announced that we were doing these shows, the stock was going to take off. It's now selling at $6.40 a share.
Right.
And we didn't buy one share because I was scared to death that you could be looked at as an insider. And so I didn't do it.
Well, I think that was very good judgment by you. That area is gray. And by the way, the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission that enforces this, they like it to be gray. A lot of people say, well, why don't you just make these rules black and white so people know what's insider trading or not? But they don't want to. They want it gray because they want people to be afraid, and they want to be able to pick and choose their cases. So you're absolutely right about that. But when we were running this program for the CIA that I mentioned, we actually called it Project Prophecy, we were finding crooks all the time. Now, we weren't looking for crooks. We were looking for terrorists. But the signals are the same. We were looking for insider trading, but mm-hmm. insider trading could come from a terrorist network that was planning an attack. And what we did, we came up with a target set. So if you're a terrorist and you're going to have an attack, what would be the target and then what would be the stock associated with the target? Because there are 6,000 stocks in the New York Stock Exchange. And from a data processing point of view, that's a huge data set because you're looking at every little tick every
right.
day. So we narrowed it down to about 400 stocks. So, you know, Carnival Cruise Lines, Disney. I mean, there are obvious hotels, resorts. There are obvious targets, and we just looked at those stocks. Nobody's going to attack Ben and Jerry's, right? You're going to attack Disney or Carnival or something like that. So we were able to make the data problem a little more manageable that way. But you're absolutely right. I mean, but we were finding insider trading, and then we were referring it to the SEC. We actually got in a little bit of trouble for that because, you know, the CIA is an intelligence agency looking overseas. It's not supposed to be doing domestic law enforcement. So we said, fine. So we called it our catch and release program. We were seeing insider traders, but they weren't the people we were looking for because we were looking for terrorists.
So when did we go off the gold standard? Was that during the Nixon era?
Well, kind of in two steps. 1933 and 1971. So President Roosevelt and President Nixon. So in 1933, get this, President Roosevelt issued an executive order. he made it a crime punishable by heavy fines and imprisonment for U.S. citizens to own gold. It was like drugs or contraband, and you had to hand it in.
Now, did that include a gold necklace, a gold tooth?
There were some exceptions for dentists were allowed to have gold, and you were allowed to have jewelry and antique coins. But if you had any bullion, so newer coins, bars, and this is obviously aimed at the wealthy, you know, the everyday American who had a ring or a necklace. No, you didn't have to turn that in. But if you were one of the people, you know, keeping bars in your vault at J.P. Morgan or something, you had to turn it in. The government actually built Fort Knox in 1937.
There's no gold in there, though.
Well, we might disagree on that. I think the gold's there, but it's leased out. Now, here's the thing. The gold is there, but it's all been leased out to the marketplace.
What do you mean, leased out? How do you lease out gold you own?
Well, you can...
Like lending it?
If I have a car, I can lease it to you. If I own a house, I can lease it to you. And if I own gold, I can lease it to you. And that's what they do. And by the way, this is not speculation, George. There's something... This is one of the most secret financial organizations in the world, but it's all documented. It's called the BIS, Bank for International Settlements. They're based in Basel, Switzerland. Now, what is the BIS? The BIS is the central banker's central bank. It's like a bunch of boys who have a treehouse and they go up there and talk about stuff that they don't want their parents to know. That's what the BIS is. Once a month, the biggest, most powerful central bankers in the world with their delegates travel to Basel, Switzerland. About 10 of them sit around in a room, dining room, overlooking the river there, and they discuss the structure of the international monetary system. There's no accountability, no elections, no minutes, no transparency.
For the entire planet.
For the entire planet. That's exactly right. But that BIS actually has financial statements, and the financial statements have footnotes. And you got to be a little bit of a geek like me, but you can read the footnotes. And in the footnotes, they say, we transact in gold leasing and gold sales on behalf of central banks and commercial banks. Here's my favorite story about the BIS. In World War II, right, the middle of World War II, Switzerland, of course, was neutral.
Yeah.
The BIS is based in Switzerland. They were buying Nazi gold, selling it for cash, giving the cash to the Nazis so that they could buy weapons. The president of the BIS at the time was an American, a fellow named Thomas McKittrick. So here you have an American running a secret bank in Switzerland, fronting gold for the Nazis to give them money to buy weapons to kill Americans. That's how...
Unbelievable. Why didn't the Nazis just buy their weapons with the gold that they had?
Well, because you have to transfer, because if you're in Switzerland, you could turn it into different currencies. It depended who the sellers were. It's a little bit awkward, but you know, some of it was private, just people kind of getting their money out of Nazi Germany. They could see the end coming. But
so they're basically washing gold.
Correct. Okay. The Nazis were looting gold. We know this, you know, obviously throughout Eastern Europe and sadly through Holocaust victims. So the Nazis were looting gold, refining the gold, selling it in Switzerland, either transferring the money abroad or using the money to fund their war effort one way or the other. But the bank that was the broker for the Nazi gold was run by an American.
And what about the bank that Prescott Bush was it? He was involved and some others funding the Nazis?
I'm not sure about that. Look, the Bush family is prominent. They've been, you know, we know Jeb Bush and George Bush, but, you know, they go back generations, and they've been not just presidents, but senators and
CIA director and everything else.
Yeah, I'm not expert on every entanglement of the Bush family, but they certainly have their fingers in a lot of pie. There's no question, a lot of pies, there's no question about that. But again, this story shows the significance of gold. And this is happening again today. There's an emerging what I call the axis of gold. And again, I want to be clear, George. Everything, you know, I'll make certain claims, but
hold on for one second, Jim. The axis of gold is what we'll talk about with phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.